Hello and welcome to the Sobre Mesa podcast with me, Alan Maguire. I hope you're well, and I hope you've had a chance to listen to our last episode, which is on Somar Owen interviewing Miguel, who is very well informed on the creation of this new left-wing platform that's kind of taken over the baton from Podemos, not so easily though, as you've probably heard. Anyway. There are elections in May in Spain and in December the general election, and it's kind of a common stereotype in Spain that whoever wins the locals will win the general, and it's no lie that the right have been up in the polls over the last sort of 6 months to a year, really pretty consecutively, but local elections also throw up various different stories and different things that we should talk about that aren't always interesting to international audiences, and they aren't always interesting to local audiences either. But this one is very much different. With me today, I have Dan Hancocks, who's a freelance journalist and author, and he is the author of the book, The Village Against the World. Now, this book was brought out in 2013, but I've wanted to get Dan on the podcast for a long time to discuss this fascinating book and the content of this book for a long time. So, Dan, welcome to the Sobre Mesa podcast.
Thanks so much for having me on, Al. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be on one of my favorite podcasts.
Cheers. People can't see, but I am blushing. It's not just a sunburn. The Village Against the World came out in 2013, and it's about a small village in Andalusia, Marinaleda. So, Dan, can you just, I mean, let's just start by talking about, this is an important local election for Marinaleda, because the legendary mayor is standing down. He's one of the mayors in Spain that's been there since the transition to democracy in the mid-70s. But before we go in and talk about him, can you just tell us a bit about the village and how did you come to write a full book about a village of less than 2,000 people, I believe?
Thanks, Ali. It's a remarkable village, and it took me a long time to even find my way to it, if that makes any sense. So I grew up in London, and I guess as a sort of A-level history student, reading about the Spanish Civil War, reading Orwell, reading Hemingway, eventually reading Gerald Brennan, the many kind of English writers or English-speaking writers that went to Spain. And sort of documented the struggles of the 20th century. I sort of became more and more fascinated with Spanish history, doing my degree. And then in the immediate aftermath of going to uni, me and my then girlfriend saved up like not even that much money. The exchange rate in the mid 2000s, when the euro had just come in, actually made it incredibly cheap to live in Spain. If you'd earned just a bit of money from doing admin jobs in London, as we had. And so we lived in Seville for a few months. And while I was there, I remember reading just a really small, literally like a paragraph news article about Marinaleda, this tiny town, in the heart of Andalusia, right in the slap bang in the middle. And I'm from London, so I don't drive, nor did my girlfriend at the time. And this town of Marinaleda wasn't on the train route, and we sort of were intrigued by it, but couldn't really see any way to get there. And I mentioned that partly because it feels like quite a remote place from the kind of urban bustle of Andalusia's big cities and the modernity of Andalusia's big cities. I am a city boy ultimately. Like I don't, I struggle in rural environments. It's not something I take naturally to. And when I finally arrived in Marinaleda, so a few years, some years later, being in an environment where when you are trying to walk down the main street and there is a farmer driving his sheep or his goats across the main road, like that was a genuine novelty to me. I'm not used to living like that. It is a sleepy, sort of quiet environment in which everyone knows everyone's business. But yeah, I'd heard about this place that was apparently a communist utopia, which sounded like an absurd sort of self-description for a town of 2,500 people. And I wanted to find out how much truth there was to that, I suppose. And there was really very little online about this town as well. You know, you've got to remember the internet in the mid to late 2000s was a much more sparse place as well. Like, you know, there's tumbleweed blowing through there by comparison to the kind of glut of information we have everywhere today. I mean, I should say, in addition to my book about Marinellada, there are now, like, if you typed Marinellada into YouTube today, there are like numerous documentaries in numerous languages. A lot of people from, you know, Germans and Danes and, you know, Americans and people from all over the world have made a little pilgrimage to it almost. It's sort of a leftist pilgrimage site, I suppose you could say. But it's also a real place where people live and have
Of
created
course.
a genuine alternative to the current sort of way of doing things. And that applies to housing and it applies to land ownership and farming. Basically, what happened was some years late after my first sort of hearing about this town, back in London during the real apex of La Crisis, when just everyone in Spain was struggling for work, when loads of people were struggling to pay their mortgage or being evicted, in sort of 2012, I would say, I met one of the many young graduates without a future, so-called, from Spain, who had come to London to look for work. Right, there was a mass exodus, a real like huge brain
That's
drain.
how I met my wife.
Is it really?
She was one of
Well,
those.
there we go. You know, the beautiful unintended consequences of like large scale political and economic failure. Always, you know, there's a romantic tinge to everything, right? And yeah, that I, you know, I met this guy in London called Javi, who was a lodger in my parents' place in South London. And I couldn't believe it when, and he couldn't believe it when we both realized that we both knew about this place called Marinellada, because, you know, he was from the nearest town. The next big, well, not even that big a town called Estepa, which has got a population of, oh, you know it.
I do.
Oh, amazing. So that has a population of like 10 or 12,000. They're famous for the biscuits, the kind of win Christmas biscuits, whose name now escapes me. But he said, look, if you want to visit Marinellada, like, come with me. I will drive you there. You can stay at my parents' house with me. I'll drive you down there. I'll introduce you to the mayor. It was, you know, it was the most sort of relaxed bit of journalistic fixing I've ever experienced. In the he was he, like he literally just when we got to Estepa and were staying with his parents, he called up a friend of his in the village, in the communist village, and said, "Oh, could you just pop over to the town hall and see if the mayor's there?" And, you know, right, okay, I've got this British guy with me. He wants to come down some point, you know, tomorrow and interview the mayor. Could we do that? Okay, yeah, we can do that. All right, we'll come down just before lunch. So I stumbled very slowly towards this place that had sort of lived in my imagination for quite a while, and became obsessed with it and determined to try and then tell its quite remarkable story of struggle since the 1970s, because that history hadn't been told, and as far as I know, still hasn't really been told in book form, despite the kind of global interest of like leftists around the world and the sort of fixation of quite a lot of Spanish and other right wingers in proving that it is not communist and it is not a utopia. And actually this Sánchez Gordillo is a very bad man who's definitely a Stalinist, and crushes, you know, the opposition with an iron fist. We can get into how true that is. It's, you know,
I mean,
but yeah, it's a remarkable place, I will say, by
I
way of
mean,
introduction.
I think in Spain as well, like to give the other side of it, it's kind of like a segment they put on the news or something that you find. It's very much at the moment clickbait. I mean, Sanchez Gordillo is standing down as mayor. He's, you know, one of the first, well, one of the last mayors since the transition, and he is very much, you know, a popular figure. But as you said as well, you know, there's 2,500 people living there. And it does work differently to your average village. I mean, and I suppose, you know, could you tell us a bit about how, I think the most fascinating one for me is the housing. How does the housing work there?
So And you've got to bear in mind that I was learning about this in the absolute kind of peak of the Spanish housing crisis, as discussed, where you know these so many companies had been just doling out these completely brutal mortgages, for want of a better expression, that people would never be able to pay the minute they lost their job. And you know, there were people working in construction who were being, during you know the late 2000s in Spain, being paid way more than anyone ever had for that kind of manual labor, because the construction boom was just insane. It was just, there was stuff going up everywhere.
I know stories of you know people that had done sort of professional training in healthcare or in law and things, leaving their profession to go and work in construction. Like
Wow, there we
not
go.
everyone was going to work to lay bricks, but there were a lot of people in you know the selling, the
Yeah.
acquisition, these kind of things as well. I mean, the
100%.
boom was enormous, yeah.
It really was. And, you know, I think probably even now you can see scars of that on the Spanish landscape when you travel around. Like, you know, a subsequent piece about the Spanish housing crisis I wrote for Newsweek magazine. I went to an urbanization, which is sort of like a large house, somewhere between a large housing estate and a town. We kind of don't really have a word for it in English, I wouldn't say. And it's not like a traditional town. It's not a pueblo. It's not kind of got this idea of a collective identity of a pueblo. It's more just a set of housing with a couple of shops
A
attached. And this
gated
was,
community, I suppose, is
yeah,
probably the best.
exactly. And this was sort of supposed to be a dormitory town on the outskirts of Madrid I went to for Newsweek. And it had been, they'd sort of built like, they were planning to build something like 10,000 homes. They got about 2,000 homes into that project when the company Real Urbis, the developer, went bankrupt. And some people had already bought their places and moved in. So you had about 150 people living in this ghost town of new builds that wasn't even finished. And they were stuck there forever. It was like literally, you know, you have no way out. No one's buying this off you, even at a rapid, massively reduced rate. And it was very sad. The number of, you know, there were hundreds of thousands of evictions. You know, this is why La Pah, which brought Ada Colau to fame, you know, I always say is like probably the most successful social movement in Europe of the last 15 years. Like they rehoused people, they blocked endless evictions. You know, Ada Colau became a sort of global name off the back of that as well, and her move into institutional politics. But I digress. So that's the context of the Spanish housing crisis,
Which
and
makes
in
the villager's story all the more remarkable, right?
absolutely exactly, Al. And like that. So the way housing works there for the well for a substantial minority of people. So some people just inherit have. These, you know, houses that have been in the family for generations, and you know they are in the regular run of things. Their mortgages are paid off. They are, you know, usually quite quaint, perfectly like reasonably sized family homes. But the new houses they started building under Sánchez Gordillo, the casitas, as they call them, you know, very traditional Andalusian white walled. You know, very quite dark and cold inside because it has to be because it's so hot in the summer. And a lovely little kind of courtyard or garden that is obviously well shaded for the same reason. But they managed to create a sort of system where which is somewhere between social housing and actually I don't know how else to describe it. It is a form of social housing. You own your home in for as long as you are, you know, you would like to sort of live there. You cannot sell it on. It ultimately revert, you know, were you to leave the town, it would revert to co the collective ownership. So it's sort of like a form of social housing. You pay a mortgage of 15 euros a month, which is basically a nominal mortgage, as that suggests. That's 15 euros. You did hear me correctly. But the other input that you make is that you build the house, basically, with help from qualified architects, and, you know, the town hall. Under Sanchez Gordillo, like you know, they're not going to leave you with a sort of IKEA flat plan sort
And
of
say good luck,
guide,
yeah.
or like just go on YouTube to look up how to build a house. You know, there is the sort of you know professional guidance there, but the idea is that you build the house yourself, and then your labor costs are deducted from the price of the house. And in exchange, you have a secure, permanent place to live for as long as you want it, and you can pass that on to your children when you die. But you just the key, this is the key thing, you cannot sell it full stop, because they do not want people to, you know, the idea was to avoid housing becoming a commodity, housing becoming a commodity which can be speculated on and profit gained from. They reasoned was, you know, exactly what was leading to this housing crisis. Albeit I should say that the Marinellada housing system predates the housing crisis by some way, basically back to the 90s, which was the kind of period when, so I should just say Sánchez Gordillo is elected for the first time in 1979, as a very young man, only in his 30s at the point, that point, under a new party that they formed, which is basically a sort of far left, but not officially part of the Communist Party, and is based around a sort of rural, a legacy, or like a long tradition of like rural peasant anarchism, I would say, almost like it's that part of the left. Anarchism in Spain thrived in Barcelona, as I think a lot of your listeners probably know, but it also thrived in the rural parts of Andalusia, where these sort of missionaries in the late 19th century had traveled around with like revolutionary tracts. I say missionaries, you know, like anarchist kind of evangelists, basically, and that had really taken root in the soil there, where there was so much land inequality. You know, the like Andalusia, unlike almost everywhere else in Europe at this point, at that point, had some of the had sort of land inequality that was comparable, really, more to Latin America and its latifundias, where you have like a statistic they would often quote is that I think 50% of the land was owned by 2% of the people, and you have aristocrats like the Duke of Infantado, who was who would just own vast, vast tracts of land and not do anything with it. Like, it was not being farmed, really. If it was farmed, it was farmed with wheat. It was, you know, they grow wheat, which requires absolute just minimal labor to sort of cultivate. And that's the other key part of the Marinellada story in the 1980s, then, is their fight for kind of autonomy in every sphere, like in the cultural sphere, in terms of housing, to sort of basically, you know, opt out almost of the kind of capitalist mode of accumulation on house prices, and speculation, but then also on work, because a town of like landless laborers, basically, essentially, like, you know, farmers who did not have their own small holdings. And it's a really, it's like a feudal, it was a feudal system almost,
I mean,
which is,
this is where a lot of the legend of Manuel Sanchez Gordillo comes in, right? I mean, he's not famous like a lot of politicians maybe for controversial policy or you know really good speeches. He's famous actually for his actions and being on the front line.
yeah.
And this is where it comes in, right? Like they were a town with plenty of people and they wanted to be self-sufficient, but you know they never had the resources.
Yeah, and that's where sort of the, you know, anarchist approach of so-called propaganda of the deed comes in, which is, you know, essentially another way of saying direct action. And it was always non-violent direct action, but extremely full on. Like, they, you know, they began almost immediately in after Sanchez Gordillo was elected mayor in 1979, with the following summer, a hunger strike, which involved 700 of the townspeople, including some children, but apparently, I don't think the kids were made to keep at it for that long, quite, which is quite right. But, you know, several of the, you know, local revolutionaries managed, kept up this hunger strike for, I think it was 9 days. And it drew attention from across the town. It was the first, oh, sorry, from across the country. It was the first time that Sanchez Gordillo was kind of launched to national and actually even international fame. Like, newspapers were interested even back then in this kind of, you know, sort of strange and remote seeming story of, like, it's like, you know, I often compare it to Asterix's village. It's, you know, it's a bunch of really unique characters doing something very different, holding out against the might of a huge empire, essentially, or at least a large nation state, and
Yeah.
the entire Western capitalist way of doing things. So yeah, they go on hunger strike for a really long period, in to demand like work and better benefits payments, because it's just mass unemployment in the aftermath of the Franco period and the transition. I think they had 60% unemployment at this point.
Wow.
And many of the people who did have work, it would be seasonal. There'd be a tiny bit of like harvesting work, and then I think Sanchez Gordillo himself, he actually wrote a book around this time in 1980, which I have just here next to me. He wrote a book. In his book, he described like the struggle that he was embarking on as a struggle for peace, but he said it is not the peace that we have had in the past of, quote, lice, gazpacho, and cortijos. Cortijos are
Right.
like a walled off farm, basically owned by a wealthy landowner. And gazpacho may be a delicious soup to many of us today, but I think for in that particular point in Spanish history, and for people with that experience of poverty, gazpacho is not a refreshing way to start your meal. It's like, this is all we have is
Yeah.
stale bread and tomatoes and olive oil and like and possibly not even much else beyond that. Like, this is
Yeah.
not been delicately balanced sort of flavors and so on. There was great hunger and great unemployment at that point, and they used the opportunity of the upheaval of the transition to say, we want something more than just the same that we've had forever,
Yeah.
which is suffering ultimately, and people having to emigrate to the big cities for work. That was another commonplace part of the history of the town in prior to the 1970s. We want something more than that. We want self-determination. We want, jobs for all, homes for all, and a rich cultural life as well, which they also very much have. They built a swimming pool. They built a lovely nature park. There's a great rock venue that people come from miles around to see. Usually ska punk bands, which is not my cup of tea, but very big in Andalusia. So yeah, the 80s was like this period of intense direct action, hunger strikes, occupations of land.
Yeah.
They marched endlessly out to this one particular field that they wanted to they were demanding be given to them, basically. They wanted to expropriate it, to use the terminology, from the Duke of Infantado. He wasn't using it for anything.
Yeah.
It was a 1200 hectare site that they thought, this is about the right size that we could collectively own and farm this as a cooperative. And they went out, they marched out there, hundreds of them, in the heat of the Andalusian summer. Like their enemies during this period are the Guardia Civil, who they have has a long history in the rural communities, as well as in cities, I suppose, of animosity between working class people
Yeah.
and the Guardia. The Guardia Civil like chopped the branches off the trees in this occupation site so that they'd have no shade. It was sort of
Jesus.
it got really just
Yeah, quite.
vindictive without
Yeah.
actually ever turning violent. And to cut to the end of a like basically a decade of endless direct action and sort of attention grabbing stunts from Sanchez Gordillo, you get to 1991. The Seville Expo is just around the corner in 1992. And I think the regional government in Sevilla are like, this is becoming embarrassing. They keep occupying the airport and the train station
Wow,
in
really?
Sevilla.
Okay.
They kind of would take minibuses, hundreds of them, to the regional capital, to Sevilla, which is maybe an hour, a couple of hours away, and do stunts there, because they understood that they'd be right in the glare of the regional media and the regional establishment, I suppose. And basically, the regional government caved. They get you know they 1991. They say, look, if you just please shut up and go away, and let us get on with staging this big enterprise of the Seville Expo,
Yeah.
you can have 1,200 hect that 1,200 hectares. We will pay off like some compensation to the Duke of Infantado to stop him moaning. and you can have that land to do what you want with it. Just please leave us alone. And it was, you know, it's a victory. It's a victory after like 12 years of
Wow.
relentless direct action, essentially.
So, I mean, they get this land, but it doesn't just end there, right? I mean, they need work. So, what is the town's next move?
So having sort of fought throughout the 1980s relentlessly, essentially to get the land that they felt was theirs, in the sense that, you know, the part of the philosophy, the specific anarcho-communist sort of peasant communism of Andalusia, of this part of Andalusia, this very rural part of Andalusia, part of their philosophy is land belongs to those who work it or work on
Yeah.
it. And their sense was like, you know, they don't, there's no desire for world domination there. Like they are quite good at sort of practicing international solidarity in Marinaleda, but really it's a very locally focused demand. They wanted some land for self-sustenance, you know.
Jobs, right? I mean, that's what it is,
Yeah, exactly.
jobs.
Literally for work and the dignity of being able to provide for your family, right? Like, so
Yeah.
work is integral to their sort of, as I say, quite unique philosophy or ideology. You know, and because all of their because in the early 1980s, you know, all of the adults and indeed, you know, indeed retired people could re just remember sort of substantial periods of either migration to the cities to look for work, or intense poverty of having to go, you know, days without food, of having to get your neighbors to buy you bread and that sort of thing. So yeah, they create a system once they've won this 1,200 hectare tranche of land to plant the kind of crops that will require work for cultivation. You know, wheat does not require a huge number of pairs of hands in order to cultivate it. It's mostly done with machinery. But if you are growing artichokes, red peppers, what else did they have? I think broccoli as well. You know, these are more labor intensive crops, and so that's generating more work, which, you know, gets them closer to their sort of goal of 100% of full employment, which they, you know, for most of the period of the Sanchez Gordillo era, the last 40 years, they have had something like close to full employment in the town. Which is remarkable when you consider how bleak things were in the early 2010s.
Yeah.
You had unemployment getting towards sort of 30, 40% in some areas, you know,
Yeah.
which in Western Europe is insane. You know, like
Yeah.
those are crazy figures. Youth unemployment was above 50% in Andalusia when I was writing the book. You know, that's how bad things got in the early 2010s. And so the labor is sort of divided up. Basically, anyone who wants shifts working in the farm, in the cooperative farm, can get them. And you know, they sometimes they would have migrants arrive in the town who'd heard about this, you know, special place where, you know, you would be treated with a greater welcome as a refugee or a migrant than you would in, you know, most major cities in Europe.
Yeah.
Sure enough, you know, they would do their best to try and find work for the few usually West African men who ended up in the town. One of whom, by the way, as a little sidebar, because this is amazing for anyone who likes football, Ansu Fati, the incredible Barcelona striker. I don't know if you know this, Al. You know, his dad was he basically is was he learned to play football in Marinaleda, Ansu
Oh, wow,
Fati.
really?
Because his dad was a migrant who had heard one of he was one of the people that had, you know, in desperate sort of times had heard like you could find work if you can make it, you know, onto the Spanish mainland and get to
Wow.
a small town in Andalusia where there is a communist mayor who you know makes sure everybody has work, and that's exactly what they did for Ansu Fati's dad, who was eventually able to bring his partner over. And
Wow.
Sufati learned to play football for the Marinaleda youth team.
Wow. Wow.
And now look at him.
Yeah.
Yes, I should big up Sid Lowe, the Guardian Spanish football correspondent, has written, there's a very long piece about Ansu Fati that he wrote, you know, the arrival of, and a star is born, that kind of thing, which references my book about Marouane Aleja and a little bit of the history there, because it is a it's a special story and a special footballer. Anyway,
No,
back to the
definitely.
song. Yeah, you basically get put in a group, a particular shift group, so you wouldn't necessarily be working every day in the fields.
Yeah.
But if you're part of shift group B, you know, then you do a certain number of shifts, and they try and divvy it up evenly so that everyone has as much work as they need. People were paid, when I was there, it was I think it was €47 a day, which doesn't sound amazing, but is above the Spanish minimum wage by some way. And I would also say, you know, cost of living in the town is really low. Like, you know, if you're buying a
Yeah.
drink, buying food out and about, it's really cheap. As we've discussed, housing, you're paying €15 a month. Like, you don't need a lot of money to live on if you are content to live in Marinaleda. And
Yeah.
that's, and your cultural life is not an expense, a great expense. Like, the swimming pool membership costs €3 a year, I
Wow.
think. Kindergarten costs €12 a month, I think, for
Wow.
preschoolers, including, you know, food for the kids and stuff. So, like, your cost of living are going to be really low. You're not paid loads by sort of, you know, city standards, but enough, I think most people would agree. They created a lot of work that way through the collective farm, which,
Didn't they get their own factory as well?
yes, that's right. Yeah. So the next stage, after sort of cultivating, irrigating, the farm for vegetables, and the olive oil plant, I should say as well, which is a big part of it. The smell of freshly made olive oil is something that really lingers in my nostrils even a decade later. It's remarkable, remarkable, fruity, kind of rich flavor. But yeah, they created a jarring and canning factory in the town, to create more work, basically, and to sell on that produce. I have a tin of Marinaleda peppers somewhere that I've kept with the sort of logo on and everything. You can't find, don't think you can find Marinaleda vegetables in your average, like, Carrefour,
No.
in downtown Madrid, but, like, you can definitely, they do stock, you know, they send their supplies out to sort of
Yeah,
neighboring
I
towns
mean,
and so on.
the cooperative movement in Andalusia is enormous, right? And in most, like in my wife's pueblo, Montilla, there are four or five cooperatives, and they're the biggest. You know, they're some of the biggest companies and employers in
Yeah,
the.
and there's Mondragon as well, which a place I always feel like I ought to have visited for comparative purposes and have never actually been to. But,
Yeah.
you know, very different model there, but a vast, vast towns-sized, you know, cooperative.
But it's
You
like
know.
it's not that odd, right? In like a
Yeah.
Spanish cultural context that this small town, I mean, okay, the housing and the you know the kind of Robin Hood style, which we're gonna go on to
Yeah.
next, is what sets it apart from other villages. But the actual cooperativization kind of isn't that. I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, I personally think it's amazing. But actually, when you see it in context to other Andalusian small cities, it's kind of like the cooperative movement is big here, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it sort of makes sense for this kind of work. It is backbreaking work in
Yeah.
horrendously hot conditions, where, you know, you want everyone to be looking out for their workmates, and to not, you know, you could be worked to the into a, you know, until you collapse otherwise.
Yeah.
Like, you know, so the fact that they have a shift, quite a, you know, convoluted shift system, which means that not everyone has to do every day, is, you know, a good thing, I think, as well. That they divide the labor up, according to how many people need and want work, you know, so people can
Yeah.
ask for more shifts and so on. And they try and negotiate that, which I'm sure is a delicate thing and potentially subject to patronage and favoritism. But, you know, that's, I suppose, where the democratic mechanisms in the town ought to kick in. They have regular assemblies. Like, you know, this is another key part of Sánchez Gordillo's philosophy from the beginning, is, you know, like, liberal democracy under capitalism instructs us that, democracy amounts to voting every 4 years and then forgetting about it and having absolutely no say or no participation after that. Something that, many strands of the Spanish left have sought to address. And I should mention that, I was out in Marinaleda right in the kind of aftermath of 15M, the Indignados movement, where participatory democracy was all the rage and being talked about and used everywhere. Everyone's got their hands in the air doing the wavy hands thing to signal assent and so on. There are sort of new ways of organizing politically were, well, not new, but like there was a real rise in that kind of approach. And in Marinaleda, they've been doing it since the
Wow,
1980s,
old
having these
hands.
kind of, exactly. Old hands, and it's sort of like, is it a corporate sort of term, the all hands meeting, where like everyone shows up? I feel like I've learned that from Succession or something, or like reading about tech companies recently. But the idea is like everyone comes down to the trade union office, which is has a hall at the back that's kind of really substantial, and anyone who wants to speak can speak and challenge the mayor, can challenge the town elected councillors about things that they, if they do see that there's, or suspect that there's favoritism in one way or another, or that patronage is being dispensed, which, is always a risk in a small community, I think. And there's definitely, I think people who felt like they were not part of, they hadn't voted for Sánchez Gordillo, they didn't like him personally, say, there was a minority, there's always opposition exists within Marinaleda, is what I'm trying to say. I guess there are always been people that voted PP. Or Pepe, I should say. More recently, Vox, but we'll get onto that in a minute. But yeah, like dissent is, like it is brooked in the town, I would say. But like there are animosities which I feel like even if there was no political color to any of these, so any sort of factions or whatever in the town, you're always going to get in a small community people who gossip against one another. We don't like one another for one reason or another, rival cafe owners on the other side, opposite sides of the street, whatever it might be. Loads of, generally everyone gets on great, but the something I found a sort of unusual as a city dweller was that sense that like everyone knows everyone's business, and if people have a dispute, then they're going to talk about it because there's not a great deal else to do in a small town but gossip, So some of that would sometimes take a political tenor, but yeah, like crucially, work and housing are there and available for people who want it, and
And
they're limited in range. Like there isn't, and I think that was a problem that I was witnessing in 2012, 2013, was that if you're a young person growing up in Marinaleda and you didn't want to work for 8 hours in 36 degree temperatures, but many kids, well, many people like my age at the time in their 20s were the first people in their family to go to university.
Right.
And if you leave Marinaleda to go to Granada, to Malaga, to Sevilla, to do a degree, and you see another way of life, a lot of those people, they would come back after university and be like, I don't, there's nothing for me here. I don't want to do what all of my ancestors have done. I want to,
I suppose the success story and part of and the mythology around the village itself is it did the be it did better than the most. Well, it did better with the very limited resources that it had, because of political will, is a big part of it as well, right? Also, the traditions of that kind of semi-anarchist, semi-communist, peasant kind of collectivist philosophy, which has great, great roots in Andalusia, as anyone that's anyone that reads about Spain will know. But the man himself, Sánchez Gordillo, is standing down. And just wanted to mention his kind of his kind of famous label in Spain is the Spanish Robin Hood, for good reason, right? I mean, because the I mean, we've been talking about this village like it's kind of sort of separate from the crisis of the Spain of 2013, 2015 kind of thing. But it wasn't completely sheltered from it all, right? I mean, housing and work wise, it fared quite well. but there were knock-on effects. So can you just tell us a bit about some of Stephen Cordier's escapades during this when he really came out of his well, come around a second time, right? Like it's
You're right. It was like a reprise, but sort of for the more interconnected, globally mediated kind of era of with the help of the internet as well. Yeah, they so if they'd had the odd sort of BBC or like German newspaper reporter in the early 80s, which was very exciting to everyone in the town to get that kind of notoriety. It was the 2012 kind of was a completely different scale. And I think, yeah, the connectedness to the Indignados moment is really interesting because and that's the Indignados was something else I wrote about quite a bit and was really interested in and remain interested in the legacy in formal politics today, as Owen was discussing on your last episode about Sumar. Fascinating to me to see how that journey has proceeded from the streets and the squares into the institutions. Like, absolutely fascinating. We mentioned Ada Colau before as another connection between protest politics and formal politics. Something that was really characteristic of the Indignados moment was this sense that they were against the status quo, but maybe hadn't quite work formulated a proposed alternative at that point. And that was the process followed that.
Kind of
That's
like
fine.
form, they wanted to change the form, but the content wasn't quite there. That's quite a famous analysis by Daniel Benabé in Spain of Conveyor Men. It was a lot of change in form of politics, but not a lot of change in content.
No, that's a really good analysis. But they were interested in hearing about alternative methods, right? Alternative ways of organizing, whether that's housing, whether that's work, whether that's democratic kind of participation. And so Sánchez Gordillo is sort of the perfect figure for that moment. And I remember in 2011 and 2012, he was being kind of called into, like, he would go to Seville basically and speak on a platform with a bunch of like kind of young urban sort of university grad kind of activists. Not that that's all that the Indignados were, but like that there was a it felt like a cultural meeting
Yeah, of
of
course.
worlds that normally did not interact particularly. But I think the young, predominantly young people who'd been taking the squares in what is it, Las Setas in Sevilla and Sol in Madrid and so on, were really interested to hear from him and hear about this alternative model. He launched it into another gear entirely in and I think you've alluded to this, when he became the Robin Hood mayor so-called in August 2012. It was basically like a bit of propaganda of the deed, a political stunt that was more successful than any they'd done before, including the hunger strike in the 80s. They took basically he and the sort of peasant anarchist trade union that they'd formed in the late 1970s went into supermarkets in I think was it wasn't actually Marinaleda itself, but it was another small town, I think. Went into supermarkets, expropriated or stole, depending on how you look at it, basic foodstuffs like rice and bread and olive oil, nothing fancy, just basic sustenance kind of staple foods. They expropriated them with, they'd invited the press along. I think they certainly had like video cameras watching them do it from two different supermarkets. They took trolley loads of food out, several trolley loads of food, and donated that to a food bank. And that, in that very kind of simple stunt that probably took about half an hour. I'm sure it took longer than that to organize, but like it took about half an hour to do. There was a bit of objection from some of the supermarket workers. They got away with it, donated it to the food bank to make a point about kind of how the lack of kind of sovereignty, as they put it, over food and over work and over housing had left millions of Spaniards in penury, being evicted from their homes, struggling with food on the table. It was a stunt. They knew it was, they would acknowledge it was a stunt. Sanchez Gordillo would acknowledge it was a stunt. Like it was about three trolleys worth of food. They weren't going to feed the entire masses of the Spanish unemployed at that point, which is, as I say, about 25, 30% among the highest in Europe. even up there with Greece at the time. This made headlines around the world. He gets called, the Don Quixote of the Spanish Crisis, or
Yeah.
William Wallace, but most commonly, yes, the Robin Hood mayor for his redistribution of food from a glo from global like supermarket chains like Carrefour, which I think is Carrefour the biggest supermarket in the world chain
I
in the world,
think
I think,
one of, yeah.
out there with Tesco and Walmart, isn't it?
But I mean, as well, I mean, it's interesting, right? The links between the supermarkets and agriculture, these monopoly sized supermarkets that basically can dictate prices because it's a product that's got a shelf life, and that goes
Absolutely.
on and affects communities, people's livelihoods and everything. So, and
It
I think.
affects the farmers. Exactly. Yeah, it's a direct line between the work they do and their sort of political goal that everyone should be able to afford to put food on the table.
He's quite an interesting character in himself, though. I mean, there are, I mean, in Leganés we have a statue to Che Guevara, but there are, murals of Che Guevara. But he also sort of says, he says I'm a communist, but I'm not in the communist party. He says that, his heroes are Che Guevara and Jesus Christ. He's very much a charismatic figure, big beard, like the sort of like prophet's beard,
No, that's a really good description. It was actually like an Irish journalist who was passing through Andalusia in the early 1980s when they were doing these sort of hunger strikes, and he describes this sort of very solemn procession of the workers out to occupy the fields, as I was describing before. And there's something almost messianic about it, basically, like that he's got this huge beard and this, he is capable of laughing and smiling. Like he's not he's an eccentric, but he's also, humane, I would say. But when he speaks about politics and injustice, whether that's in Palestine, Western Sahara, or Andalusia, because he likes to proclaim and declaim a little bit about stuff beyond the village. Always wears a keffiyeh, for example, the Palestinian scarf. But when he speaks about politics, it is with the sort of fiery rhetoric of a preacher, I would say. Like there is a sort of religious infusion in it, stylistically almost, to how he talks. He's an immediately striking presence. It's a really interesting dynamic that I tried to unpick when I was researching and writing the book, of how the relationship between charismatic leadership, almost cult-like kind of veneration of the leader, and the fact that this is, supposed to be like a very participatory, grassroots, almost horizontalist democratic project with its roots in rural anarchism, which is quite it's a contrast there. It's not in the legacy of the PCE and sort of, very hierarchical kind of leftist party organization. It's supposed to be, all of us are in this together, and there's just one person who
Although
happens to be the leader of the
the
project.
other
But
side of that, though, is he as you mentioned earlier as well, he's talked on a regional level, but he has they were his party, their sort of collective, were some of the founding members of Izquierda Unida about 37
right.
years ago, which the birthday was yesterday.
Oh, really?
I think it's kind of he was he's had a profile in regional politics in Andalusia, right? I mean,
Oh,
but I just don't think he I well I think there's been clashes
that's
on the
right.
left, as there always is, but
He was in the regional parliament, it's worth saying as well. So he was, as well as being mayor, he was elected as a deputy to like a representative in the regional parliament, for the CUT, which is the particular sort of small party they formed, again very rurally focused, like for the Joneleros, which are the, like, landless laborers essentially. That's what that political formation was around. But yeah, they've had some interesting alliances. I'm trying to remember what he said about Podemos when Podemos emerged. I think he was broadly pro, but I think Podemos did possibly stand candidates against him in the Like he wasn't part of Podemos basically,
Right.
but you know, he welcomed the fact that there was a new formation on the national scale, on the national level,
Yeah.
I think. But yeah, they've always had their quite a distinct version of Spanish kind of leftism or socialism or communism that is
Yeah.
particular to the rural environment and the Andalusian rural environment, especially, and that it's all based around work essentially, and you know,
Yeah.
laborers without land. But yeah, some interesting alliances along the way, some interesting confrontations along the way. I mean, the Spanish right-wing media despise him and have enjoyed, I think, relished kind of the it's funny, they relished the like Robin Hood stunt almost as much as the left did, I would say.
Yeah.
Like they in that they relished railing against the, you know, the idiocy and the triteness and the
Yeah, look at these
hypocrisy.
dirty commies in the
Yeah,
village. Yeah.
exactly. You know, the real, you know, there are working class people working in this supermarket who you've ruined their day, and that, you know, they try and find anything. And one of what I mean, there are sort of many criticisms leveled at the project, at the village, and at Sanchez Gordillo. One of which is that it's not a truly independent sort of communist microstate. It is reliant on state subsidies and handouts for everything that they've built there, you know, including, like we talked about, housing. The architects are provided by the and paid for by the Andalusian regional government, as far as I can remember. Now, to me, that doesn't seem like much of a criticism in that, like,
No, not really.
they fought for these subsidies, for the, you know, the money that was paid to the Duke of Infantado to buy that 1,200 hectare tract of land that they've turned into productive farm. You know, they were given that by the state. They were given that by the state after 12 years of like relentless direct action
And hunger
and
strikes. I
struggle.
mean, yeah, Jesus.
So I don't, you know, that's not, you could style that as a handout, but you'd be ignoring the fact that they fought unimaginably hard for an extremely long
Of
time
course.
in order to get it.
Of course.
And without that, they would, you know, I don't know, it's a good counterfactual question, actually. What would have happened if
I mean,
had they never
yeah.
tried? I think there would have been a lot of migration from the town,
I
you
mean, we
know.
talk about empty Spain a lot, as kind of something that's slowly been happening over the last probably 50 years. I mean, probably as far back as the big migrations of the 60s to the cities. But this village isn't empty. I mean, that's a
No,
fact.
it's
I mean,
not. And, you
there
know,
are, yeah.
even in spite of the dynamic I was describing before, whereby, you know, for young people, it's not quite such an appealing offer to, you know, work in those horrendous heats of the sort of Andalusian summer. You know, they've still maintained, the population is still the same as far as I understand, and they're still building new houses, you know.
Yeah.
Using that amazing system.
Yeah. So I mean, there's a lot. It's difficult to cut through, right? I mean, all of the Robin Hood stunts that and this kind of mythology and the leadership. We talk about, is it a communist? Like you said at the very start, is communist utopia is kind of a strange description. But it does seem that this general, well, these local elections, things are going to change. Sanchez Gordillo isn't standing this
After
time around.
44 years. I mean,
Yeah.
what a term of office. Yeah, I mean, I should say, like, if for anyone who wants some of the insights into sort of his unique charisma and personality, and the sort of problems they've had along the way, the last chapter or so of my book is kind of, it's like it, it's I end the book kind of expecting the project to collapse almost, because it looks like Sanchez, this is 2013, Sanchez Gordillo has sort of become, has had some physical health problems. He's also been suffering from depression. He's sort of withdrawn from public life a little bit. And it seems inevitable at that point in 2013 that he's going to stand down, right? You know, it's been a great 34 years. I guess it was at that point, done really well. Maybe it's time to move on and hand this on to someone younger. Look at everything you've created. That's great. Time to stand aside. But it was like no one else wanted. It was like, well, I mean, his opponents in the town obviously wanted him gone, but nobody on his side, none of his supporters, which I would say is generally about sort of 60% or something in the village, like a clear majority, there was no one willing to take his place. It's kind of a big ask. There are big shoes to fill. And so he kind of has kept going for two more terms, which I can't honestly say how well he's handled his duties in the last 10 years, because I've only been back once, about 6 years ago. But he wasn't in great shape in 2013, so it's definitely about time that the poor man retired, and someone with a bit more energy and perhaps I was going to say a fresh approach. No, I would like this project to continue, and it's going to be very interesting to see in this election that's coming up, whether the tide will finally turn, and whether for the villagers of Marineleda that the project was the project, and it was contained entirely within Sánchez Gordillo, the man. That's going to be really interesting to see. Like, Vox have done well in recent elections there, as they have across Andalusia. They came third, I think, last time.
So Vox, I think Vox came third in the regional elections, right?
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah, it's just alarming to think that there are some Vox people in this town who've been sort of quietly going about their business all this time. But the rise of Vox across Andalusia is an alarming thing, and it's a complex issue which you guys have dealt with in great detail elsewhere. But
Right. I mean, I looked at the 2019
yeah.
election results, and it basically said Adelante got 891, and they got six councillors, and Avance got 849, I think, or 47, sorry. And they got five councillors. I think that's kind of an alternative to his one.
It's going to be really interesting to see what happens. The guy who is head of the list for Sánchez Gordillo's party is a guy called Sergio, who's a teacher who I interviewed in my book back 10 years ago. And he was a young, kind of enthusiastic leftist councillor and supporter of the project. He was, I guess, probably about my age, so about 40 now. He was like really committed to the project, a really good example of a young person who hadn't been there in the 1980s experiencing the hunger strikes and stuff. He was too young, like me, but who understood what it had given to his parents' generation and the stability that it had given, and the assurance of work and housing and so on for young people there. So he was an exception in a way, in that he wasn't sort of desperate to go and work on the Costa and sort of, learn English and learn French and travel the world and so on. And I guess, well, like, he will be mayor, I suppose, if his slate wins. It's just going to be very interesting to see which one does. It was always PSOE, SOE, who were the opposition until about 5, 10 years ago. But with this splintering and reconfiguration that we've seen in the last decade, how you end up with, Avanza and Vox.
The PP got something like 40 votes in the 2019 elections. They came fourth, apparently. Which, I mean, it's difficult to know what's happened in the last 4 years, right? I mean, but as you say, this kind of project is encapsulated by a thing of time, I suppose, but also it's kind of representative of Sanchez Gordillo's trajectory of more than 40 years of service and office, really. Interesting just to see what happens to this place. Is it going to continue as it has, or?
Completely. Is that, are we go, will we look back in 10 years' time and say, wow, that was a extraordinary 44-year period that was entirely self-contained? I mean, I think it would take a lot to break up the sort of the way that the collective farm and the factory and these other substantial institutions that have been created by through struggle, essentially through collective action. So I don't think anyone would want to dismantle them. I don't know, maybe Vox would, but I don't think they're going to get in, touch wood. It's more just sort of, will they soften the leftist edges? Will the kind of solidarity marches with Palestine, or the, you know, they used to take Palestinian kids as refugees for sort of summer holidays and stuff. Just to, you
Yeah.
know, there's a lot of kind of extracurricular leftism going on, for want of a better phrase. You know, and they party really hard in Marinaleda. It's one thing we haven't really had a chance to talk about, but they, you know, their feria, their carnival, you know, these are like major events, as they are in so many sort of small and large Spanish towns. But you know, they are always kind of, they always have a leftist tinge to them as
Right.
well.
Okay.
Yeah, so what happens next culturally and socially, it's gonna be as interesting as what happens next politically.
Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, Dan.
No worries. Thanks, Howard. It's been a pleasure.